everybody, and welcome to NPR's On Science podcast, a weekly roundup of reports on the wild and wonderful world of science. I'm Dan Charles. We've got reports on how you, yes, you, may be able to travel into space, about hairy ball molecules, about fat rats and mice that smell light. Intrigued? I hope so. In recent weeks, several different companies have been planning space flights and even selling tickets on them. One of those companies, Space Adventures, produced this video.
Participants will experience a few minutes of weightlessness and marvel at the Earth below. But most of all, they will get their astronaut wings by having actually reached the border of space.
That's assuming this plan comes together in the next couple of years.
That's Steve Inskeep, host of NPR's Morning Edition. He went on to talk about this with NPR's science correspondent, Joe Palca. So let's go back to Steve and Joe.
You would not go into orbit, but you would climb to an altitude of about 65 miles. And if you don't like that plan, you may, within a couple of years, have your choice of space flights on a Russian craft or on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. NPR science reporter Joe Palca is following this story. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
Why is everybody getting into this business now?
Well, if you talk to them, they say, hey, we've been working on it all along. You guys are just paying attention. But the answer is, there are opportunities to do this, and the time is coming when it's actually going to happen.
There are people already collecting money for this.
Yeah, Virgin Galactic, you know, you can put a deposit down with them for $20,000. Space Adventures will take your money. So it costs a lot more when the flight comes along. It's about $200,000. None of the companies have rockets to go up yet, but several of them are in the testing phase, and they really do expect to have these services available by 2012, 2013, 2014.
When you say they'll take your money, are they guaranteeing a flight? You get a return on your deposit? What is this?
Yeah, no, they, you know, you get your money back if it doesn't work. But they're confident enough, and people are anxious enough to spend the money. They've collected millions of dollars now for people who just say, take me.
If I do this on Virgin Galactic, do I get frequent flyer miles?
I think they're still working on that little point there.
Okay, so how soon could this actually happen?
The first powered test flight of the one that Virgin Galactic is going to use is supposed to happen later within the year. They had a glide test just last week where they checked out the aerodynamics of the craft.
What does that mean, a glide test?
The first step of these planes are all glide, like the shuttle. You get a powered ascent, and then you turn off the engines or you run out of gas, and then you glide back down.
Okay, so Richard Branson is excited about this. He's going to go up there himself?
He says he is. In fact, it was amazing. After his test flight, he said, yep, I'm going to do it, but first I'm going to make sure it's safe. Here's what he said.
Somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, I think, realistically, is when we'll first, well, when I'll first board the spaceship with my children and my parents and go on the first voyage into space.
Which sounds like he thinks it's going to be safe if he's going to take his entire family on board, but can outsiders know that this is safe?
Well, that's an interesting question. The regulatory framework for regulating this new industry isn't fully in place yet. That's why the law says now that if you buy a ticket on this plane, the liability is on you.
Well, wait a minute. If I get on a regular airline flight going someplace or any kind of tourist flight, I might be covered by any number of consumer protections. Do any of those laws apply to space flight in the same way?
Well, right now, no. In fact, you're not even called a passenger if you get on one of these things. You're called a space flight participant. This was written into a law a few years ago because, first of all, they wanted to have no liability at all. And people said, well, what if your spaceship blows up and it falls on somebody? I mean, those people can't sue you? And they said, no, okay, those people can sue you. But the passenger, or excuse me, the space flight participant cannot sue you.
I want to ask about another thing, though. Astronauts have to train sometimes for years for space flight. Have they arranged these in such a way that you don't actually have to have rigorous training to do this the right way?
Well, it reminded me of like a resort course in scuba diving. I mean, you learn the basics. So you learn you're going to experience this, that, and the other thing. In this case, you have to see if you're going to be able to withstand 4 Gs or 4.5 Gs as you re-enter or take off.
So they
might
put you in one of those centrifuges
exactly.
To see if you're...
And to see if you're going to pass out or, you know, you have a heart problem. I mean, they don't want to kill you in this exercise.
Kind of bad
but,
for business.
But like scuba diving, there are certain inherent risks, and they want to get you acquainted with those.
So you're not actually orbiting the Earth. This whole flight would take... what, a few minutes, a few hours?
No, it's in the range of minutes. It's not going to be. It's like if you recall the first flights of Alan Shepard, it was a suborbital flight. He goes up, he goes weightless, he lands, parachute. This one, they're going to go up, go weightless, turn around, and fly back to where they started from. One of the companies called X-Corp has just signed a deal with Curaçao because the island of Curaçao in the Antilles is creating its own spaceport. And their advertising shtick is you get to go into space in the morning and you get to scuba dive in the afternoon. I mean, talk about your vacation. What'd you do this week? Ah, a little scuba diving, a little space flight, you know, the usual.
Well, Joe, thanks very much for the update.
Okay.
That's NPR's Joe Palca bringing us the latest on plans for space tourism.
Maybe it was just the thought of a vacation in space that inspired Joe Palca, but he had another brainstorm this week. He came to us all excited and said he had a story about the discovery of a Frank Caspar Sigma Phase sphere-forming block copolymer melts. Naturally, our first reaction was, Joe, that's amazing. Tell us more. So he did.
Bear with me on this because it's a really cool story. So to start, don't think about Frank Caspar Sigma Phase sphere-forming block copolymers. Think about a ping pong ball. Frank Bates uses them all the time.
Our other favorite tool are marshmallows and toothpicks or coffee stirrers. Very low tech as far as the visualization goes.
Bates is a chemical engineer and material scientist at the University of Minnesota. He uses these marshmallows and ping pong balls to make tinker toy-like models of the molecules he's studying. These molecules are block copolymers. They're a kind of plastic. The copolymer part means they're made from two different plastics, the end product having the best properties of both. For instance, new plastics that can be disposed of easily.
We had synthesized these molecules and wanted to understand how they organized themselves down at that molecular scale.
So he and his students shined a powerful beam of X-rays on them.
We found something that was simply inexplicable.
They had a shape that no one had ever seen in a plastic before. Bates says part of the explanation seems to be related to the ingredients he used to make his plastic molecule.
There's one part of the molecule that doesn't like the other part.
So the one part of the molecule folds up into a sphere, forcing the other part to the outside where it makes little tendrils.
It's kind of a hairy sphere.
The X-ray pictures of the particular block polymer Bates was studying, and in case you're interested, it was a mix of polyisoprene and polylactide and polystyrene, polyisoprene, and polyethylene oxide. Anyway, those X-ray pictures suggested something unusual was going on.
There was some new way of arranging our hairy spherical particles.
Now here's where the ping pong balls come back in. Whoa. You can use them to study how spheres pack together. I brought some to the studio when I interviewed Bates. He was impressed, but not that impressed.
What you don't see and you don't have there is the ping pong ball with the pipe cleaners that are festooned around the ping pong ball, which create this image of a soft, squishy, hairy sphere.
You need ping pong balls and pipe cleaners to get a real sense of how soft, squishy, hairy spheres of block copolymers fit together. And, as he reports in the journal Science, it turns out the way Bates's spheres fit together resembled nothing so much as something called the Frank Caspar Sigma Phase. This is just a name for how the spheres pack together. It's never been seen in plastics, but it has been seen in some common metal alloys like stainless steel and certain forms of uranium. So how is it that a plastic resembles uranium? Bates has an answer.
I think what this work does is that it makes contact with something that is more universal than just plastics. It has the capacity to teach us how nature works. And, you know, ultimately, that's my job, is to do that.
Working with plastics to understand how nature works. See, I told you this was cool.
That's science correspondent Joe Palca. A new scientific study that came out this week is challenging familiar ideas about genetic inheritance. We can't change the genes we got from our parents, but our DNA is controlled by a kind of chemical instruction manual. And those instructions can be rewritten by our circumstances, for instance, by obesity. And the new research suggests that those rewrites can even be passed along to our children. Here's my story about it. Margaret Morris studies overweight people. She's a researcher at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Recently, she was looking into reasons why the children of obese mothers often become overweight themselves. But then a new graduate student arrived in her lab from Malaysia.
And she'd noted in the clinic that when a child arrived for weight management, usually both parents were obese, not just the mother.
This wasn't too surprising. It makes sense. If a father is genetically predisposed to obesity, his daughter might be too. But Morris wondered whether she might be seeing more than genes at work. She set up an experiment with lab rats to see if the biological consequences of a father overeating could somehow get passed on to his daughters.
This was a study I did for love. I didn't really have much funding for it. I had to crib money from all over to do it.
She took a group of genetically identical male rats and put half of them on a high-fat diet. Predictably, these rats got fat and suffered symptoms of diabetes. Then all the rats mated with normal females and had children. Morris looked specifically at the daughters. All of them had the same genetic makeup, but those with overweight fathers had some of the same problems their dads did. They weren't overweight, but their production of insulin was impaired.
In a way, it's saying, like, the metabolic sins of the fathers can be visited on the daughters, even if the daughter hasn't been conceived yet.
Andy Feinberg is at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore. He's director of its Center for Epigenetics. That word, epigenetics, is getting a lot more attention these days. It refers to things in and around our DNA, billions of chemical marks that attach to it, for instance. Those marks are signals that turn genes on and off. They tell the genes of a liver cell to behave differently from genes in a blood cell, for instance. The sequence of our DNA, the human genome, has been called the book of life. Feinberg has his own metaphor for the billions of added signals that he studies.
I would consider the genome to be the words and the epigenome to be the grammar.
The grammar?
Yeah.
How the grammar?
Well, because it helps to tell what the genes are actually supposed to do and puts them into context.
Our genes don't change, or if they do, it's rare and random. But the grammar of the epigenome is changing all the time. It can also be disrupted by chemicals we eat or breathe, and evidently by obesity, because Feinberg thinks those fat dad rats in Australia created sperm cells with a different pattern of epigenetic marks on their DNA. That's how the effect showed up in their children. The study appears in this week's issue of the journal Nature. Michael Skinner at Washington State University says epigenetic effects are swinging the pendulum of scientific attention from the genetic code back toward the impact of environment.
That's probably through more epigenetic mechanisms. There's also a baseline genetic element of biology, and the two combined will actually give us more information about how things work.
Much of epigenetics is still a mystery. Scientists would like to know, for instance, how often epigenetic signals are passed on from parent to child or even to grandchild. So Margaret Morris in Australia is hoping to repeat her experiment and see if the effect persists over multiple generations. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington. And now from epigenetics to optogenetics. Stroll past a bakery and special cells in your nose begin sending signals to your brain. And somehow, the brain figures out whether the odor is French bread or cinnamon rolls. Now, scientists are beginning to understand precisely how that happens, thanks to some extraordinary mice. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, these mice can actually smell light.
They look just like other mice. And Venkatesh Murthy, a neurobiologist at Harvard, says they act like other mice when something interesting reaches their nose.
When they encounter a new odorant, like they're just going about the business, something interesting or new comes along, they just sniff faster. They go...
But these mice also sniff faster when you shine a blue light on the part of the brain that processes signals from the nose. That's because the cells in this area have been genetically altered to respond to light as if it were an odor. And that means scientists can study the circuits involved in smell with a precision that's impossible using actual odors. So Murthy and a team from Harvard and Cold Spring Harbor Lab decided to use these unusual mice to explain one particular feature of our sense of smell.
Let's say that there are three kinds of citrus fruits. You have an orange, lime, and lemon. If you really are careful, you can distinguish each of those just from the smell. There's something slightly different about them, but you can also say that they are similar.
The scientists expected to find that this was because brain cells responding to orange were physically close to the ones responding to lime and lemon. But Murthy says experiments using light showed that where the neurons were wasn't the only important factor. It also mattered precisely when different neurons responded by emitting an electrical signal.
So you can find neurons that emit right at the onset of sniff, another one will emit a little bit later. So I think even within a sniff, the timing of when the neuron decides to then do its thing carries information now.
information about stuff like whether you're smelling a lime or a lemon. Murthy says this sort of research should help solve other mysteries, too, like how odors are connected to memories and emotions. And he says the new ability to put light-sensitive cells just about anywhere might help people who have diseases that affect the retina.
Your photoreceptors have degenerated, but your eye is perfectly fine otherwise. These people are blind. So people are working on putting this light-sensitive protein in those surviving cells. That will allow you to detect light.
And maybe even patterns of light. This is all part of one of the hottest fields in neuroscience right now. It's called optogenetics. Dylan Klein is a researcher who was involved in some of the first optogenetics experiments at Yale. He says hundreds of labs are now using the technique because it lets scientists control a wide range of brain circuits with just a pulse of light.
If you understand how different circuits work for memory or depression or motor problems, then you can get at how we can try to treat those circuits in a more sophisticated manner.
The new research appears in the journal Nature Neuroscience. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And that's NPR's On Science podcast this week. You can find even more stories on our website, npr.org/science. I'm Dan Charles. Thanks for listening.